Okay. Tell me what all of these things have in common. A man juggling active electric stun guns while standing in a kiddie pool of water. A woman who calls herself a laughter coach, trying to teach a whole bunch of people how to laugh properly. Two elementary school children who can reenact with disturbing accuracy the romantic dance sequence from the 1987 film Dirty Dancing. And a pig in a tutu honking a horn. Guesses? Give up? All of these are acts who have appeared on America's Got Talent. Yeah. Do you know this show? It's a variety show slash reality television competition with no rules about what sort of act or talent people who perform on it have. So if you really want to fall down a YouTube black hole, Google weirdest acts on America's Got Talent. And please enjoy. Here's what I don't understand about this show, especially some of the more bizarre acts. Like one time, one of the videos that I saw was a guy who came out dressed as a pancreas, like the organ, and rode a bicycle around while spitting pillows out of his mouth. I don't understand why anyone would want to go on the show. I mean, the guy who spits pillows, he has to know he's not going to win, right? He got booed. No one liked his talent. He jumped through all the hoops you must have to go through to get on a television show like that, and that's what he got for it. I guess you have to admire him, even if you're not into what he was doing. But it baffles me. I cannot imagine taking a risk like that for something nobody is going to understand. America's Got Talent. The word talent, interestingly enough, used to be a word that just meant money. If we were with the disciples in the temple, listening to Jesus tell this parable, when he got to the part where he said the master gave his slave 5 talents, we would all have gasped out loud or done whatever culturally appropriate thing they did in that time and place to convey shock. 1 talent was enough gold to pay a laborer's wage for 15 years. 5 talents is a lifetime of riches. So talent used to mean money, but over time it's come to have a different meaning for us. Now the dictionary definition is a natural aptitude or skill, or the ability to do something unique or special. Some scholars of language trace that shift in meaning to this parable and the ways we have interpreted it over the ages. Because, you see, this has never been a story about money. From the very beginning, the talents in this parable have been a symbol of something else, some other kind of currency, something bigger than cash. I want us to get close to this parable today, and that won't be easy. This is a gospel lesson that is loaded with 2,000 years of interpretive baggage. And to our modern day ears, it's a tough parable to hear. It's even harder to understand. Like all parables, Jesus tells us this story in order to turn something in our world inside out and upside down. But it's hard to get close to this story, where it seems like poor people get poorer and where someone is cast into outer darkness. We can't get there without first understanding the worlds, plural, of this parable. So first, let's examine the world around the text, the world of the community for whom the Gospel of Matthew was written. The parables that show up exclusively in Matthew's gospel are difficult to understand, and knowing who they are written for helps. This was a community in distress. First, they were a Jewish Christian community having tough conversations, conflicts even, over who could be a Christian. And at the same time, dealing with pain from being excluded by other Jewish people who thought that being Christian meant they couldn't be Jewish. So this gospel was written for people in conflict over identity and belonging. Also, they were probably among the first wave of Christian communities dealing with the reality that Jesus might not return in their lifetime. They're a couple of generations out from his ascension, and so they're starting to think that his return is less imminent and trying to figure out what that meant. And we can see these concerns in the way this community held on to this parable. A parable where there is a master who leaves for an indeterminate amount of time. And a parable that asks some serious questions about who will belong in the household of the master when he finally does return. So that's the first world, the first piece of context that I want us to have. The second world I want us to visit is the world inside the text, the world of the story we are hearing. At this point in the Gospel of Matthew, it's Holy Week. Jesus is facing his own death. We're in the final countdown. We're at the end of a long series of parables Jesus gives to his friends and followers and enemies, they are also listening, as he prepares to leave them. Jesus knows that his friends are facing a world of hurt in the hours and days ahead. They will feel abandoned at his death. And even after Jesus is resurrected, the lives of his friends will never be the same. The disciples think they're going into a world where Jesus will be physically present and in charge, and that dream is going to crumble. So maybe Jesus wants his disciples to remember this parable and to know that he would never leave them with nothing. Notice the slaves already belong to the master. They're already provided for. None of the three of them are expected to live off of the talents they are given. Even the slave who is too afraid to use the money in trade doesn't appear to need it to survive. The master is gone, but his household is still provided for. The extravagant amount of currency he puts into their care is extra, surplus. Not meant for their survival, but for some other purpose. Maybe Jesus also wants the people listening to him to remember this parable and think about the fate of the slaves. That's the scariest part, right? At the very end with the outer darkness and whatnot. Maybe he wants them to think about that and how the two who take a risk and use the extravagant, lavish wealth they are given are invited into joy, are taken even closer to the heart of their master, and how the one who buries the wealth and lives in fear ends up outside, alone. Maybe Jesus wants his friends to take heart and keep doing the risky things he has taught them to do, to keep loving each other extravagantly, to keep risking their own lives for the sake of helping the poor, to keep living as if each moment was the moment that mattered the most to the world. After all, as he tells this story, this is how Jesus is living. He is about to meet the most risky and most important moment of all, the moment where he gives up his life in order to become love, where he dies in order to become the most extravagant, lavish, incredible gift God could have given to us. Stay close to me, this parable says to his disciples, and you will trade in the currency of God's kingdom. You will risk and love and live. And in the end, there will be joy. Which brings me back to our world. And America's Got Talent. See, if we're using this parable as a lens, then it isn't the weird things people do on America's Got Talent that should draw our attention. It's their willingness to do them. Especially the super weird ones, like the pancreas pillow guy, whose only real reward is 5 minutes on TV with people booing him. Our world isn't first century Jerusalem or third century Jerusalem. And it is not a reality TV show either. Our world is a world where men abuse women so often that no headline surprises us anymore. Ours is a world where mass shootings are so common that I honestly cannot keep track of which one I should be preaching on from week to week. Ours is a world where children are dying by the thousands in wars funded by our government, and refugees cannot find shelter, and fear is the currency that drives us and holds us and shapes almost every move we make. And yet here is our gospel. Here is our Jesus, giving us the currency of God's kingdom to hold and to steward and to spend. Here's this parable asking you and I a question. What extravagant gift from God are you holding in your life today? And I'm not talking about how well you dance or sing or spit pillows. I'm talking about the extravagant ability to love and to risk, to take heart in the face of great challenge that God has given to you. I am talking about the deep well of forgiveness or courage or hope or faith that you are holding in your hands and in your heart today. If anything will turn our world upside down, if there is anything that will give this broken place glimpses of God's kingdom, it is your willingness to use those gifts. And there's nowhere we can get them except from Jesus, from the one who has faced every fear in human life and answered it with eyes wide open. Love. This same Jesus, the one who is with us in the Eucharist, the one who is present every time we're scared, alone, hurt, or abandoned, the one who inhabits our hearts to the extent that we can recognize him, this Jesus is inviting you and me and all of us together into joy. But we cannot find this joy if we're afraid to use what God gives us. We cannot find it if we take these gifts and bury them or build walls around them or hide them until the end. The extravagant love and hope and faith and courage that you have been given as a member of the household of God is meant to be used. And the promise of our scripture today isn't that we'll be able to double our money or win anything in the contests of fear that rule our human cultures. The promise is that if we live into this wealth, if we use it and share it and trade it, if we become people who are not afraid to risk, to love, to speak, to include, and to live, the promise is that in the end, however and whenever it comes, we will belong in the heart of God, where there is no fear, only love, and only joy.